will call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. Welcome. Colleagues, members, our agenda today includes the work session on 2876 that was carried over from Tuesday. I am prepared to open this work session if the committee has any questions for ODF and W on the bill. I think the order we do this, we'd hear from Representative Wisnett, who's here on 2867. Let him come up and testify. And then I did tell ODF and W, which sat through the entire hearing on Tuesday, expecting we might have questions on 2876. If the committee wants to hear from the department on 2876, I think now would be a good opportunity to do so. I would point out there is a roughly $250,000 fiscal on this bill. It does have a subsequent Ways and Means. I am not prepared to move this bill on the Ways and Means today, but I did want to take advantage of the opportunity to hear from the department if members of the committee have questions about that. So while you're thinking about that, let's...
I'll wait.
Okay. Thank you. Sure. Representative Wisnett, is there an interest in hearing from...
Whenever there's an opportunity, Mr. Chair, of grilling the Department of Fish and Wildlife, it makes my day.
All right. So that's what we'll do. We will open a work session on House Bill 2876. And you'll recall, members, that this bill came to us from... I have no idea. Senator Girard, I think, was, I think, the sponsor, one of the sponsors of this bill. And I'll invite the department up in case members of the committee have questions. Again, I'm... I think the fiscal on this warrants additional consideration before we move the bill on to Ways and Means. But I did want to give you folks the opportunity to say a few words or answer any questions.
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We are here today to answer any questions that you may have on the bill. We did certainly testify on it when you had your public hearing. Happy to answer any questions you may have. I do have with me Mr. Steve Marks. He's our South Willamette Watershed District Manager, so the Santa Ana Basin falls in his area of expertise.
And I stand corrected. This bill, the sponsor on this bill is Representative Clem. Are there any questions for the department? Representative Krieger.
Kurt, didn't we hear an informational hearing or something regarding this issue last session? It seemed like we had a bill had to do with something there, and I just wondered if you could, and it was Representative Senator Girard at that time, I think, that brought it forward. Do you recall that bill?
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, Vice Chair Krieger, I believe that last session's bill was essentially identical to this bill, or extremely familiar to it, extremely similar to it. We did have a public hearing last session. I do not recall if it was worked and moved to Ways and Means. I want to say that it may have been, but I'm not going to. I'd have to go back and look at the records to confirm that.
In your opinion, is it merit that this at some point needs to be done?
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Krieger, you know, this reach of the river, of the Santa Ana, has a number of large diversions. Certainly there are habitat issues there. There are listed species in the basin as well. There may be opportunities to improve the fish habitat in that reach. I would like to offer Mr. Marks here the opportunity to address the question as well. Certainly there may be opportunities to do things there.
Just was saying, if there's opportunities, that means fisheries enhancement. If it's fisheries enhancement, that means opportunity, and that means licenses sold, and actually some benefit more to the state, and also more opportunity for guides. So we need to understand that while there's initial output, there could be long-term benefit from it. And even if you get into the endangered species and other things we're dealing with, maybe that habitat needs to be developed. I would hope the department would take a look at it. I did see, Mr. Chair, was it $275,000 or something of that nature? That's about a year and a half of one person's time. I cannot see how it would be impossible I think I made the comment one time when I saw one of these, give me a case of beer and two lagers, I can do it in 30 days. So I don't think it's, I think the impact is overstated.
Yeah, it's $230,000 fiscal. Do you want to address the fiscal piece and then
sure.
we can get back to that?
Thanks, Chair Cannon, Chair Gailey, members of the committee. You'll note in the fiscal impact statement there's an estimate of $120,000 for a private contractor to do an in-stream flow study. That is truly an estimate. It may be able to be achieved for less than that. It's certainly not a minimal fiscal or no fiscal, but this is our best estimate. It may, in fact, come down in if we go out with a request for proposals to conduct that study. It's just our estimate at this point.
Do you have any comments?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. This is pretty diverse reach with the different diversions there. We've got two listed species in the river itself, winter steelhead and spring chinook salmon. One of the other factors that plays into this, we also have Oregon chub ponds within the reach, so that's where in part the flow study comes. Those habitats for those species are very tied to water elevation. So that's a key factor, and we are aware of several issues in the reach with respect to passage and some other side channel habitat, but specifically what the proponent of the bills are looking at, we're a little bit unclear, but those are the types of initial assessments that we would prescribe for the reach.
Can you give us a sense of the priority in terms of focus and opportunities that exist in this reach of river as opposed to any other reach of any other river? This bill is very specifically focused on a particular section of river. Do you share a sense of priority with respect to the opportunities that may be available available there?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, there are some priority components in there. Certainly one of the priorities is moving fish through there. We've identified one passage facility, a ladder in the reach that could be upgraded, so that's one, but overall, there's a lot of activity in the North Saniam Basin with the Upper Willamette Recovery Plan and the Willamette Biological Opinion. So there's a number of other factors in play here that could influence the habitat in there, especially water temperatures. But a lot of the focus has been on upstream habitats and access for fish to those locations.
Great. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still on I want to follow up on the Chair's question about why we're doing this. And but maybe this question would frame the issue better. That particular reach, I think, is below Detroit Dam. Is that right?
That's
and
correct.
I think there's been some discussion about the core doing something with all the water that's stored behind the dam. To this point, that water has been viewed as natural flow after it comes out of the dam. But in the future, it may well be that water would be available for allocation. The odd thing is most of that water has already been allocated because it's been treated as natural flow. My concern about what you're doing here, where you focus on inflow needs, is that you'll be creating a bucket which will have to be filled with some of that water out of Detroit. And that means that the standard created by your study would then become a foundation for this exercise of releasing water. Now, that would bother me because I don't see that in this bill anyplace. So my question to you is the standard you're establishing here going to be used for any purpose other than those that we've heard about today? Because you've talked about it in pretty broad context. And just to share with you, I worry because the in-stream flow needs analysis is done from the standpoint of the fish, which is your job. But then it's used as a device in allocating water for every other purpose. And that bothers me because the fish then, that standard then tends to become an end-all be-all. And don't want that to happen without us knowing what we're doing. So maybe you can shed some light on what I've just said.
Sure. Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz. I think as the bill is currently written, we're taking a pretty broad interpretation of what a study of a zone to improve fish habitat is. And certainly when we talk about fish habitat, water is an important component of fish habitat. In this particular case, and Mr. Marks alluded to it, we have in the basin three different listed species, one of which is Oregon chub. These are all federally listed species, one of which is Oregon chub, which resides in off-channel, slow-moving, pond-like habitats versus listed spring chinook and listed winter steelhead, which certainly require a flowing river with good stream flows. And so I think from our, based on our interpretation, we do look at this study as including stream flow as an important component. If the bill were amended to focus on only on other items, we'd be happy to look at that as well. But right now we're taking a very broad interpretation. And I think you're correct that people use flow studies for fish to determine other, to balance other water needs. There's no doubt about that.
Quick follow?
No, that covers it. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I'm not prepared to move this bill along today, committee. It may warrant additional attention. I think we'll see if we hear from Representative Clem or Senator Girard on that. But for the time being, we will close the work session on House Bill 2876 and open a public hearing. Thank you for coming. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2867. And we have a number of folks here to testify. We're going to start with Representative Wisnett. And anyone you want to bring up with you? And you want to give us a summary of the bill, please?
Of course.
You're always surprised when I ask you, because I don't always remember.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2867 would eliminate the requirement to repeal certain groundwater mitigation rules that were adopted by the Water Resources Commission for the Deschutes Basin Groundwater Study Area. It would also allocate a certain amount of money to the Water Resources Department for grants relating to groundwater mitigation and require the department to study the impact of mitigation credits and projects on the Deschutes Basin.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and co-chairs, honorable committee members. Hope you've had a wonderful St. Patrick's Day. Can't say top of the morning, top of the afternoon to all of you. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, state representative from House District 53. I really appreciate you hearing this. We've had some meetings. I appreciate it. I hope I'm going to try to be short because we've got a lot of experts that are going to come in and talk to you about this. And I want to give you some points to start the discussion. In 1995, federal agencies used the U.S. Geodetic Service study to essentially impose a moratorium on any economic activity in our area. They determined that any additional water rights use, either surface or groundwater, would negatively impact the Deschutes River. As a result, no new water rights would be issued in the basin. Our region faced a choice: get into the water war, roll up your sleeves and go to work and figure out a solution. And that's exactly what our region did. Starting in 1999, the legislature on a bipartisan basis passed a series of statutes that created a unique program that brought the agriculture, irrigation, the cities, tribal, and conservation interests together to do two things: allow for a system of reallocation of water rights for user to user, for instance, agriculture to cities, and incentivize transfers that would leave water in stream. Let me repeat that: incentivize transfers that would leave in stream water in stream in exchange for equal or even a reduced groundwater right. It's pretty simple, as you know. In water, nothing is simple. It took us three sessions and five separate bills. The last bill I worked on in my first session here, the bill was sponsored by Senator Ben Westland, and we achieved what we have now for the current Deschutes River mitigation plan. Mr. Co-Chairs and committee members, many of you have received emails from citizens opposing this bill, indicating that we're not following the Scenic Waterways Act. Colleagues, I received similar emails opposed to the legislation when we passed it in 2005 to recreate the mitigation plan. However, colleagues, the mitigation plans worked. You'll hear about it in more details later. Let me give you one simple fact. In-stream flows in the Middle Deschutes River have more than tripled as a result of this program. Before this program, flows in the Middle River ran as low as 35 cubic feet per second. This past summer, the flows were well over 150 cubic feet per second. Why is this important? Because it's the Middle Deschutes River that has been in trouble. The Lower Deschutes River below the Pelton Brown Butte averages over 4,000 cubic feet per second. But in the Middle River has traditionally flowed at this much lower rate of between 35 and 150 cubic feet per second. It's this mitigation program that has brought the parties in the basin together to work to fix this problem. Again, colleagues, please look at the successes of this program and support this bill. As I have done and other agencies have done, like Oregon Water Resources Department and the local conservation groups, including the Deschutes River Conservancy, they recognize we're not reducing the stream flows, and we're not violating the Scenic Waterways Act, and we're not draining the river. The numbers are clear. Both the middle and lower river flow readings are up. Thus, the program has worked. It has allowed us to reallocate existing water to different users. It has incentives for conservation. It's made huge strides in restoring the Middle Deschutes River. And it's brought the diverse users together to find a solution. To me, and I hope for you, it's a win-win. And as a result, I ask your support of House Bill 2867. We do have a -2 agreement, which came from all the interest in the basin, and we support the -2. Mr. Chairs, I'll be available for questions, but I think there's a lot of experts behind me that can answer some of these. This program has worked. That's the point I'm trying to bring to you. We had a plan. It worked. We're not destroying the river. I have a lot more constituents that fish and recreate in the Deschutes River than want to build developments or that have cities I'm concerned. We want to keep the river flowing. We want to keep it available for the fish and for recreational use. But this plan does that and still allows for economic use of the water. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Are the -1 amendments also yours?
We support the -2.
The -2. Okay. Are there any questions? Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll hear first from Alan Unger, Patrick Griffiths, and Steve Johnson. Come on up.
Sit to the side. Okay,
So we have a timer, but I'm not planning on using it. Just so folks know, we have about 15 people signed up. I think if our witnesses are pretty cognizant of their time, trying to keep their comments to maybe 3, 4, 5 minutes, we can get through everybody without having to resort to the timer. So let's move forward in that spirit, see how it goes. Gentlemen, in any order.
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, and County and Committee. My name is Alan Unger. I'm a Deschutes County Commissioner. Before that, I was Mayor of Redmond for 8 years. So all the time we've been working on these mitigation rules, I've been elected official, I've been at the table. I'm also Chair of the Deschutes Water Alliance. It's a group that has come together to work on a basin plan. It took 2 years for us, and you'll get a copy of this, to develop a memorandum of understanding that includes all the local governments, the tribes, the counties, the cities, the irrigation districts, and also the major state agencies, ODF and WDEQ, Bureau of Reclamation, in a con- consensus-driven purpose to create a basin plan, an integrated regional water management plan. And our goal is to secure water for the rivers, which is fish, wildlife and people, agriculture, and cities. In 2005, we had a Bureau of Reclamation grant that helped us study the hydrology, identify and quantify our water demands, and develop options for new water supplies. We have done great things since that study was done with large-scale water conservation projects. We've developed a Deschutes Water Alliance water bank that manages water rights and reduces speculation, and we've put more than 200 cubic feet per second into the stream. We have great momentum. This groundwater mitigation reauthorization is key to us. It's an important tool for us to use in our plan. So the regulatory stability is a must for us. We are doing great things. We are an example for others. And when you see the rest of our presentation, you'll know why. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Patrick Griffiths. I'm the Water Resources Coordinator for the City of Bend. I was here 10 years ago testifying on this issue when we had House Bill 2184 that really kicked off the issue. I was asked at that time to bring you the blue whale. We brought it back. And as the only recovering middle school teacher on this panel, I've been asked to lead off and kind of guide you through a little bit of the background that may help your understanding of this bill.
Well, you have a current middle school teacher on this panel.
Absolutely. So what really we have going here today is a little bit of history that's really the history of the West. In the 1900s, the water rights were taken by the irrigated farmlands out there as appropriate. In the 70s, others turned to groundwater because all the surface water was appropriated. In the 1990s, Representative Wisnett referenced the USGS study that basically made the connection from the upper river to the lower river. If you look on your packets, you got a blue whale from us, a nice copy you can fold out and take a look at. It's at the top of the packet that's being handed to you right now. That might be something to open up and look at as I go through this presentation. But essentially, the Deschutes River is a wonderful bit of hydrogeology. I also have an interesting textbook with me today. It's a 1905 USGS study that basically identified the hydrogeology we're still living with today, and it was well understood then. We just have better numbers today. So in 2002, when the department took House Bill 2184 and essentially began developing the mitigation rules, they required mitigation in the basin. So now we have one of the largest management areas in the state related to the surface and groundwater management. You can see it at the center of the map of Oregon here. It's quite a large geographic area. If any person or any group is trying to have a new groundwater right within that boundary, they have to mitigate for the use. Here's the blue whale. Let me just walk you through it. The wider the width of the blue, the more water is in the river. So this is the typical, what we would call natural flow. The Water Resource Department calculated this for us. And what this means is it's a typical natural stream continuum. Starts small in the upper basin, and by the time it hits the Columbia, where we put the smiling whale face there, just to help you kind of identify with this, here's where the Metolius River comes in, 100% groundwater. And the Crooked River comes in here. You can see it's a very unique river that it's special for Oregon. As you look at the summer flow impacts after irrigated agriculture and the humans came into the basin, the middle river was essentially brought down to a trickle, as Representative Wisnett indicated. And then because of that, the upper river has more water in it as they release stored water at the during the irrigation season. What that does in the winter is reverses it. They're holding back all the water in the wintertime, which reduces the flows in the upper river. So we have kind of a backwards hydrologic challenge to overcome here without tipping over an important economic apple cart. And we've been doing that successfully in our processes. Here's the map that you have in front of you. And again, the reason I'm showing you another view of the same graphic is the groundwater hydrology is the critical piece that makes this basin unique. We essentially recharge in the Cascades about 3,800 cubic feet per second annually, and that water flows under Bend and under the upper basin and then returns in this area down low and discharges back to those three rivers in the Lower Crooked, the Metolius, and the Deschutes around Lake Billy Chinook, and makes that flow go up so much in the lower basin. The water rights today are very well understood in the basin. About 90% of the water rights issued are for agriculture, and you can see the other 10% are for the other uses identified, both municipal, industrial, resorts, and in-stream. We did a study with the Bureau of Reclamation called the Deschutes Water Alliance Basin Study. Started in 2004, wrapped up in 2006, and what we discovered was about 75% of the new needs in our basin were for in-stream needs. There's no pushback from that number. 25% was for new out-of-stream needs, and you can see the agricultural is the largest chunk, municipal is the smallest, and the other incidental uses happen sort of outside the municipal areas and the county areas. Everybody's pretty confident in these numbers and very agreeable to them. Again, no pushback. The slide I'm going to leave you with before turning it over to my partners both here today is certainty. That's really the main thing. When I put on my city hat, I want to talk about the foundation of the economy in Central Oregon is certainly water, both in-stream water and out-of-stream water. Water supply certainty for us is the key piece. I told you I was here 10 years ago testifying on the same issue. It took us 16 years to acquire our last two groundwater permits. And I'm still not done with those permits because now I have to mitigate for those permits. I have about 2,400 mitigation credits left to purchase with a price tag of somewhere between $2 to $10 million. If this mitigation program were to go away and uncertainty took over, that price could go well above that. Really hard for a municipality to plan system development charges, water rates, hookup charges when you don't know what your future water costs are going to be. Certainty is key for municipalities to plan. That predictable regulatory framework is really what we need. And defining the investment also tells you who needs to pay. And that really helps define the roles and responsibilities in the basin. With that, I'll turn it over to Steve Johnson.
Mr. Co-Chairs, I'm Steve Johnson. I'm the manager for the Central Oregon Irrigation District and also chair of the Deschutes Basin Board of Control, which is an organization under ORS 190 of the seven larger irrigation districts in Central Oregon. I want to take Patrick back to the pie chart with the 75%, 25%, please. As Patrick mentioned, and Representative Wisden had mentioned also, we'll go back to the reclamation study that was performed in the basin a few years ago. And the future needs out 50 years were identified. This basically represents reallocation, and the reallocation comes entirely from the irrigation districts. We have over 90% of the surface water rights, and as Patrick mentioned, there's no pushback on the needs and identifying those for in-stream. I'll also mention to you the agricultural, that'd be ag-to-ag transfers as part of our plan. And so for the plan, for the basin, we're looking for stability, we're looking for certainty, because there's significant investments that have already been made, and we need to make significant investments going forward. And so bounce back to the map. It's an outline of the seven primary irrigation districts in Central Oregon. You have Bend, you have Redmond, you have Prineville, Madras, Sisters. A unique aspect of the Deschutes Basin with our canals is that we lose between 40% and 65% of the flow in the canals from seepage. Okay, that we have the opportunity of creating win-win situations in that if we can conserve the water by piping or lining, we do not have to take extra water out of the river that for us gets lost on the way to the farmland. And so there's already been tens of millions of dollars invested in conservation. We've also invested in hydro plants that generate green energy at the end of the pipes that save a lot of water that goes in stream. So that investment's been made because we have a plan. In addition to that, since 2005, next slide, please. Thank you. This is the pie chart in a different form. Where is that the reallocation of the 100% going to come from the study? Now, half of that has been identified with the piping and lining, the conserved water that the farmers don't lose, what we call the headgate water, were able to permanently, through the conserved water statute, protect and place water in stream that no one else can divert. Okay, and that's about 50% of our target, we believe, can be economically funded through piping and lining. And as I mentioned, several projects have already been completed. The middle part, which is more pertinent, say, to the conversation we're having this afternoon, is with transfers. And this 30% of transfers is representative of both permanent and temporary. But within the permanent category, specifically for mitigation, the irrigation district I represent, Central Oregon Irrigation District and Swallow Irrigation District, have voluntarily removed water rights from our certificate to go in stream in order to provide restoration flows for the river, as well as to provide water supply under the mitigation program for the municipalities. And so there are no other areas in the West, Western United States, that voluntarily remove water from their water rights certificate to do this. When I speak with people from other states, they want to know what's in our water. But it's a paradigm shift. But that's what we've successfully been able to do with support from our elected board members as well as the population in Central Oregon. The last part of our puzzle, I should mention that the 1,000 acres that have been removed off of certificate has increased the stream flow component over 16 CFS just from those water bank transactions. The remainder part of our plan is with reservoir management, which is coming into the future. So at that, I'll end my comments. Todd?
Okay. Co-chairs Cannon and Gilliam and distinguished members of the committee, my name is Todd Heisler. I'm the executive director of the Deschutes River Conservancy. I wanted to take you back to the blue whale just to focus you on the problem areas. So these are the big problem areas that my organization and my partners have been focused on. And what you should notice here is we have a summer and a winter problem. And you might hear in testimony coming up that, yeah, we've got some seasonal issues. We've got issues in the winter, in the spring, in the fall, and in the summer. And when we solve these, and I think we're confident that we will in time, as we're working on this together, we will move the river back to a more natural hydrograph, never trying to achieve, you know, pre-settlement hydrograph. But as we move it back towards a more natural hydrograph, we will naturally put the river into a functional, a more highly functional river that will solve a lot of the problems, I think, that the river has suffered from in the past. So we're very confident that we're going to solve this problem going down the road. So one of the things I wanted to point out with mitigation, if you notice, so Bend, and then here's the lower river, the big, the fat wedge on your whale. So when we drill a well here, we intercept groundwater that would otherwise end up down here. So when we retire a COID water right and put it in stream and Bend, we get two benefits. We get 100% restoration flow in here. We've now restored that hole in the river, in the middle of the river. We've also now mitigated for the loss of the water down here. So we get two benefits out of this program. We get 100% restoration in that middle part of the river, and we get a mitigation impact in the lower. And it is a very powerful thing, and it's really helping us restore the river. Next. So you won't see a chart like this anywhere else in the state of Oregon. There is no other place in the state of Oregon where you see this kind of protected in-stream flow. The green wedge is the mitigation impact, the impact of all those transfers that Steve mentioned. The blue is really that conserved water and other permanent transfers that are done for restoration purposes and bought by restoration buyers. And then the gray wedge at the bottom where the voluntary contributions by the irrigation districts, that was really the baseline, the foundation that we built on. So it's really important to get that. All of these pieces have to work together. It's what the Water Alliance is about. It's the principles upon which the Deschutes River Conservancy was founded. Now, the mitigation looks small, and in fact it is. As Patrick mentioned, the cities actually don't need a whole lot of water. But it's a foundational cornerstone of the program because you need to have your local governments enrolled in this. We're not going to restore the rivers to the extent that we need to without having the cities and the counties and local governments bought into the program and participating. We also need to be able to bring all the investment together.
So we need to have everybody playing together, investing in the restoration. And the beauty of the program is that it aligns all the local interests in an in-stream flow. No matter who you are, you have to care about flow in the river. This is a very powerful motivating force. Next slide. So not only are we working very hard to restore the river, we also know that restoring the river is going to be very important for us complying with ESA, Endangered Species Act, obviously our Scenic Waterway Act, the Clean Water Act, other regulatory drivers. Now, we're not saying that mitigation can be a double counting, that somehow mitigation here can have some credit in achieving these federal regulations. But the fact of the matter is, when you put over 200 CFS in stream, the water quality improves, the fish habitat improves. And so this program is helping us manage our liabilities under a whole range of other regulatory drivers, and that's really, really important. And again, I'll stress that we won't get there without all the investment coming together. So the state's not making major investments, neither actually is the federal government. This is locally driven to a large extent. We need every dollar that's available for this kind of program to work alongside every other dollar that's potentially available, and so that we can actually get enough money to restore the river to really comply with these regulations. And that's one of the powers of the mitigation rules. So I wanted to end with just basically what Patrick said, that regulatory certainty is probably the biggest and most important factor here. We're not going to get the local governments to be at the table, stay at the table, bring their resources, their influence, and their money alongside of restoration and conservation interests if we don't have stability in the law. If they believe we don't know what's going to happen, there's too much risk associated, this kind of alliance will break down. So it's extremely important that the sunset of this law be repealed, so that we have consistency and we have certainty. And with that, as I said, where else in the state are you getting this kind of collaboration, this kind of working together to put water in stream and protect it? The river is much better off, not just because of the mitigation program, but it's been a very important cornerstone in our success. So I wanted to thank you, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Todd, it seems pretty clear that the program is mitigating for flows during the summer months when some of the irrigation water is not being used. What's happening during non-irrigation season in the river?
Well, first of all, during non-irrigation season, if you've seen the city's demand curves, they have an irrigation season too. So their water use actually looks a lot different in the winter than it does in the summer. So yes, there is potential year-round pumping by the cities, but it's a lot lower than it is in the summer. You have that factor offsetting. The other thing is, ultimately, the reservoirs need to come into play. If you saw Steve's chart, it's identified as an answer, but frankly, in the collaborative solution, the reservoirs are not going to be the first thing that get decided. So we've got a bank, we've got conservation, we've got infrastructure. I think people have to extend us and the partnership a little bit of trust that we're going to ultimately deal with the seasonal issues, which are part of the plan. And when we do, I think those will be the mitigating effects of, if you will, of the mitigation program. But I also think you have to look at how water is actually used year-round to understand what the risks are, and we don't think they're actually very big today. Did that answer your question?
There are others. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. The economy in Central Oregon is pretty challenged recently. So how does this continuation help or not your local economy? Whoever wants to answer that.
Do we want to answer that? Commissioner Conger?
Chair Cannon and Gilliam and Representative Vince. Our economy is challenged. It's challenged basically for the moment because of the over house building we did and jobs and that sort of thing. But over the long run, our economy will come back, and we need these type of tools to be able to look into the future and make sure that we're ready for what comes next in our economy. If we're going to be looking at industry, we need a tool to be able to manage water and the other aspects we need to have that industry here.
Hello, Mr. Chair. I was actually involved in this in 1994, 95, and 96 when I was chair of the Water Resources Commission, so it's interesting to see it all these years later and see the successes that it obviously has generated. I'd like to take credit for part of it. I can't. It was basically Senator Bryant and Martha Pagel that helped put the thing together, and so I'm very happy to see it working this well all these years later. It seemed to me that the basin was totally appropriated, and the studies that were done and the work that you guys have done has provided a foundation for the future of that most important part of our state. So to me, this bill is a necessary part of extending what I see as one of the most collaborative and successful efforts we have going in this state. When one's tempted to compare it to the Klamath area, but I won't. I'll just say I'm very, very happy that you that the senator, excuse me, the representative brought this bill, and that our previous senator helped to generate it. So, thank you very much for all your hard work.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, we'll excuse you. I think we'll hear next from some folks who have signed up in opposition, and that includes, we'll start with Kimberly Priestley, Jim Myron, and Tom Wolfe. We'll have another panel of opponents to hear from later on. We have some additional supporters as well.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Jim Myron. I'm representing Water Watch of Oregon here today, and with me is Kimberly Priestley, the organization's senior policy advisor. She will be giving the testimony, but let me just make one comment before we get started here. We were provided with the Dash 2 amendments on Thursday of last week, and it was indicated to us that that would be what we were working from then on, or the Dash 1 amendments. And so the comments that Water Watch has prepared are based on the Dash 1 amendments. We have not seen the Dash 2 amendments, and it now appears that the Dash 1 amendments are no longer under consideration. So if we're back to the original bill with Dash 2 amendments that we haven't seen yet, it creates a bit of a dilemma for us. But we will proceed based upon what we have prepared, and with Kimberly's 10 years of history on this issue, we should be able to get through it and give you some of our concerns and also offer up a couple of alternatives for your consideration.
Can I just clarify with a head nod perhaps from Doug that you are pursuing the Dash, I don't know if I'm violating some sort of protocol here, but it is Dash 2, okay. So that it, I think proponents, most of the proponents at least, are here on the Dash 2. You're going to address the Dash 1 because that's what you've seen. Okay.
Co-chair Cannon, co-chair Gilliam. For the record, my name is Kimberly Priestley, and I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. Rather than go through my written testimony, I wanted to highlight a few points. First of all, I wanted to start out by saying, you know, what is at issue today is the future of Oregon's rivers, not just the Middle Deschutes River, but the Metolius, the Whiteshoes, the Crooked, and the Lower Deschutes Rivers. These rivers are not only treasures for the local community, but also for the state and the nation as a whole. People travel from all over the place to fish, to raft, to hike these rivers. Moreover, as you know, you've heard from some of the proponents, federal, state, tribal, and private interests have spent millions of dollars trying to restore these rivers. And these rivers are a very important contributor to Oregon's economy. In a nutshell, it's in everyone's interest, whether fisherman or city official, to protect these rivers. With that, I wanted to give a very short background on the laws that are, you know, at risk by continuing this program. The Scenic Waterway Act was voted into law by the citizens of Oregon in 1970. This act declares that the highest and best uses within scenic waterways are recreation, fish, and scenic attraction. Under this law, where groundwater measurably reduces scenic flows, as it does in the Deschutes, the state cannot issue new groundwater rights unless they provide mitigation that ensures that these scenic flows are protected year-round, and that year-round part is very important. Similarly, and the In-Stream Water Rights Act was adopted by the legislature in 1987, and what this act does is it protects water in-stream by virtue of water rights, which are on, by law, equal footing with all other water rights. So, you know, they get the same treatment as a municipal right or an irrigation right or any other consumptive right. And again, in-stream water rights are set, they have flows for every month of the year, so this law protects flows year-round. Does the mitigation program meet the mandates of these acts? The answer is no. This went to the Court of Appeals, and in 2005, they ruled that the mitigation rules, as they stand, do not meet the mandates of the Act. Despite that, the legislature in 2005, as we heard from others today, passed House Bill 3494, which allowed the mitigation rules to continue despite the court's rulings. But I would like to point out that there were two important safety nets in this bill, and that was, one, the Water Resources Department was required to report to the legislature about how the program was working in 2009, which they've done, and two, there is a 2014 sunset. And these two together provided an avenue so that if the program wasn't working, it could come to a halt in 2014. So how is the mitigation program working today? As you heard from Todd and others, in the summertime for the Middle Deschutes, it's working great. You've got flows increased in the Middle Deschutes, and you're keeping downstream flows in the Lower Deschutes steady. However, it's not so rosy every place else and during other times of the year. Some of the problems, I won't go through all of them, but some of the key problems that still exist with the rules are the timing of mitigation. As you've heard, almost all of the mitigation to date is going into the river during the summer months. The modeling by Water Resources Department shows that there is diminishment of flows in the other months, and most worrisome is the diminishment during the fall and the spring months, because those are times that are important to fish. The other key problem that's still plaguing the program is the placement of the mitigation. Currently, the department is not requiring that mitigation be put in all streams that are impacted, and instead they're requiring that mitigation be put in what's called the primary zone of impact. And so what that means is, if a water right application comes forward and the department determines that, say, 70% of the impact is going to be on the Middle Deschutes and 30% of the impact is going to be on the Metolius, the department will require mitigation just on the Middle Deschutes. And so the Metolius in this case would lose out. We're seeing that in a number of cases with sort of the mitigation is sort of easier to find for the Middle Deschutes, and so some of these other smaller streams are being harmed. And the last point, as far as things that major things that probably should be fixed, are the class of water rights needing to mitigate. Currently, new water right permittees are mitigating, and that's a good thing. But there are approximately 200 water right holders out there that have a condition of use that we think requires the department to enforce to have those folks mitigating as well, and thus far that has not happened. And I would like to point out that the negative effects, at this point, the negative effects that we're seeing are only hitting the in-stream water rights. In other words, the diminishment of flows are not being taken out of, say, the City of Bend's water right or COID's water right. The flow decreases are only being taken out or being felt by the river. And, you know, so where are we today? With the upcoming 2014 sunset, you know, we're at a crossroads on how we want to move forward with the mitigation program. We want to be very clear with the committee that we do not oppose the mitigation program continuing into the future, but we do think it should not move forward into the, it should not be extended into the future without addressing the few problems that remain with the program. With that in mind, and also, frankly, you know, just to highlight this point, we have spoken with folks in the basin, and we understand the need for certainty as far as mitigation banking, you know, stocking up credits. You know, that makes sense. And so we have come up with two proposals that we think help reach that certainty for users in the basin, but also provide certainty to the in-stream interests. The two paths forward that we would propose, and the details are in our written statements. The first one would be to lift the sunset permanently, but only if the bill included a provision that required the state to address the problems of the program before it lifted the 200 CFS cap. The cap is currently found in rule. This would provide certainty both to the users in the basin and also to the fish. The alternate path would be to extend the sunset for a few years and direct the department to address the deficiencies that they outlined in their 2009 report to the legislature. Again, this provides certainty both to the users and to the fish. And, you know, I did want to say a few more things about certainty. This popped to mind as I was listening to Todd and others talk about the importance of the mitigation plan, you know, to their interests as it moves forward. Without addressing the outstanding issues plaguing the process, I would argue that there's not certainty. I mean, right now, water right applications are being challenged. They're being protested because of some of these flaws. And so, you know, if we truly want certainty in the basin for everyone involved, I think it's in everyone's best interest to fix these problems, because then we can move forward with mitigation that gets water to people, you know, water to fish, but also stops sort of the legal wrangling on this issue. You know, in closing, I would stress that there is time to deal with this. The sunset is coming in 2014. There's plenty of room under the cap. There's no real rush to lift the cap. So I think there's time for stakeholders and the state to come together and develop answers towards these problems. And with that, I will take any questions.
Great. Let's hear from the last panelist.
Oh, sorry.
The questions. Yeah, thanks. Tom.
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, committee members. My name is Tom Wolf, the Chair of the Oregon Council of Tribe Unlimited. I've prepared written comments that you see there. I'm not going to go by that. You can just look at those, and I support what Water Watch has stated. What I want to talk about is in September 14th through 17th of this year, Tribe Unlimited, a group of 150,000 members, will be having their annual meeting in Bend, Oregon, where literally several hundred TU members from across the country will be visiting. We were asked, this meeting was set up it wasn't my idea, it wasn't anybody in our organization, it was set up by Visit Bend, the Visitors Association for Bend. And we were coming out for 4 days, which a lot of that will be fishing trips, and millions of dollars, thousands of dollars, maybe millions, will be spent by our members when we're out there. The Deschutes Basin, and the reason I bring this up, the Deschutes Basin, when you think about it, is considered one of the top 50 trout and salmon streams in the country. It is a location that people, literally every year, they come out to. And one of the importance of in-stream flow is to protect the habitat of those salmon, steelhead, and trout. And one of the reasons, you know, I'm pleased for the efforts that the partners have done to protect flows in the middle of the Deschutes and the Crooked and the Metolius. I would like to see that considered. We did not see the -2 amendments. We only saw the -1. So whatever happens in this whole talk, there must be water for fish. in this. So I ask that whatever happens, whatever the talks go, that fish be actively considered so that continue to be conventions like the one we're having, continue to be visitors that come out and visit Ben and fish and put money into the local economy, because the Deschutes and the Crooked and the Metolius are national treasures. They're not just treasures in Oregon. They're national and international treasures that are on many people's 50 streams we want to fly fish before I die list. So I just ask that fish be considered as very important in any of the considerations made here. Thank you.
So, questions? Representative Krieger.
You mentioned a court ruling.
Yes.
Was that in a state court or a federal court?
Yes, I'm sorry, I was unclear on that. That was the Oregon State Court of Appeals in 2005.
And that was based. And that was based on either administrative rule or state statute.
Yes, Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger. Yes, it was the ruling was based on the State Scenic Waterway Act and the in-stream water rights. And again, those acts protect stream flows year-round. And one of the things that the court spoke to was the fact that the rules allow what's called volumetric mitigation. In other words, a user can add up the volume of all the water he or she uses over the course of the year and choose to mitigate for that amount at any time during the year. It doesn't necessarily require that mitigation be put in year-round while the impacts are being felt year-round.
So it was a state court ruling on a state law. And would you assume that this body has the authority to change that? This body?
Yes. And Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger. Yes, that's precisely what happened. My point is that there are these longstanding river protection laws that are supposed to be protecting stream flows year-round. The court found that this rule, the mitigation rule, did not meet the standards of the Scenic Waterway Act or the In-Stream Water Rights Act. So the legislature put into law House Bill 3494, which basically said, despite what the court found, that this doesn't meet the mandates of the In-Stream Water Right and the Scenic Waterway Act, we're going to deem mitigation satisfactory. That's...
I do this all the time. Move that mic just a little back.
Sorry.
Oh, wait, there you go.
Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Krieger.
I looked at the charts and the presentation of the progress that's been made, and I think there is progress been made, and I think the group seems to want to continue to work in that direction over time, realizing that they have an obligation to do that for the river and the resource, the communities, the state of Oregon. I don't see them, if we were to change it like they want to, that they're going to run away and back away from it. So I want to hear more, but the other thing, you said you could have 150,000.
We have 150,000 members. We're not going to have all of them show up.
Because I don't want them all there drinking water, or we don't have none left.
No. Probably just a few hundred. Sorry. Yeah, but they won't be drinking water. So. That's what the 9 breweries there are for.
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger, to answer your question about the efforts that are ongoing in the basin, yes, we applaud the efforts of the Deschutes Resources Conservancy and others to both restore stream flows and provide mitigation. I do want to be clear that a lot of what you're hearing today is about restoration, which is great, but that's a separate thing from mitigation. But I also wanted to make the point that, I think Todd maybe made this point, is that the mitigation program has served as a driver to move interest in the basin towards these programs that are helping our streams. And right now the driver is from the mitigation program is for the summer months. If in fact the program were fixed to require mitigation in all the streams that are being impacted and during all the months the river is being impacted, that would serve, again, as a driver to solve the year-round problems. And again, I would point out that while the work that has been done has been great and we applaud it, it is focused primarily on the middle Deschutes and the lower Deschutes. They're not the same efforts at this point happening on other streams that are being impacted.
Shirley, what does mitigation look like when it's not happening during the summer months? So the type of mitigation that you're, I guess, envisioning that would take place during spring and fall, what are some examples of...
Yeah, Co-Chair Cannon, that's a very good question, and I'm not prepared to give you the precise answer, but I can tell you that the one thing that pops up time and time again in conversations is stored water. There is storage upstream in the Deschutes. There's storage on the Crooked. The area where there will be continued problems are the Metolius, because frankly there's no mitigation there any time of the year right now. But again, you know, we may not all have all the answers today, but there's time. We believe that there is time to bring stakeholders together in the basin and develop a path forward that is more protective of the river. And that is what we are asking for.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kimberly, you referenced the 2009 report that referenced deficiencies in the plan. Could you give me kind of a executive summary of what those deficiencies are so that I can get a better feel for what it is that you were describing?
Sure. Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Witt. The 2009 report to the legislature outlines a sort of a select number. It's not a huge list. On that list is the timing of the mitigation, so the non-irrigation season mitigation. On that list is the zone of impact issue. So, again, the issue of mitigation on all streams that are being impacted. On that list is water quality. And, you know, there are a number of folks, I don't think anyone's spoken to that today, but there are concerns about water, you know, the effects of decreasing these cold springs and, you know, mitigating with water that's not as cold. On that list is the issue of the 200 water rights that are out there with what are called the 7J conditions. Those are probably the biggest one. There were other issues that were identified and that the work group, which Water Watch was part of, were able to spend time on to come to resolution on. And those were primarily small fixes to the rules that allowed the cities greater flexibility and latitude in developing their mitigation, and also a new way of accounting for mitigation under the cap to give it more room. So, you know, we feel like in these discussions we have been fairly responsive to the needs of the users, and, you know, at this point we're asking that the same time be dedicated to solving the problems that are affecting the rivers.
Thank you.
Thanks. And we'll have the department up later on, and we may find out more from them. Seeing no further questions, I think I'll dismiss this panel. Thank you for your testimony, and we'll bring up several more. Doug, why don't you come on up? And we'll hear also from... Norman Ritchie and Brenda Pace.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs, Central Oregon Cities Organization. I am the person responsible for working with all the colleagues in the basin to draft all these bills since 1999, so I really appreciate you being here today. There's a lot I want to cover. I am passing out two sheets. The first is a blue sheet that gives you just a basic understanding of the statutes that were referred to earlier. And this really is a part of a collaborative effort with all the interests in the basin, and I really emphasize that, starting back in 1995. on the bill that Senator Bryant introduced. We had House Bill 2184, which set up the authority to have a water conservation bank, established conservation standards, pushed all the cities towards metering, xeriscaping, et cetera, which we embraced widely. In 2003, we authorized specifically through First House Bill 3215, and it was folded into Senate Bill 820, a program that allowed you to transfer your existing surface water right to a groundwater right. In the temporary leasing program, what this means is you leave 1 gallon in the river and you get a half a gallon back in a groundwater permit. In reality, what that means is you often get much more than a 2-to-1 benefit because groundwater pumping is inconsistent, and the most you could ever pump is that half gallon for the gallon you put in on under a temporary transfer. And many of these groundwater permits are issued and go months or years before being executed. So there is a gigantic net benefit of this program directly to the river. Which I would mention also, this whole program benefits water quality. If you're leaving more water in the river, you're improving water quality by definition. Another key element was House Bill 3217, also folded into Senate Bill 820, which authorized temporary leasing of agricultural rights to municipalities. Herein lies one of the problems and one of the reasons that we're asking for a permanent extension of this program. It's been difficult to get all the parties to contribute as much as they might since this is a temporary program. And so extending the program means permanent, hopefully, transfers and permanent protection for the river. And then the last one I want to talk about briefly before I get to some contradictions of testimony you heard earlier and emails that you've received is to talk just briefly about the court decision. Representative Krieger mentioned the court decision, asked a few questions about the court decision. The court said a lot of things in its decision, and I won't go into the details. It's a very lengthy decision. Several of the facts I could spend a lot of time arguing were simply interpreted upside down. The fundamental thing the court said is they didn't know if the legislature had the authority or understood that it had the authority or had expressly authorized this program. And so the court basically, in the end of its decision, said, we're not sure if you meant what you did over this period of time. You need to go back and reaffirm, if you want this program to continue, that you in actuality meant what you said in these bills. And so that bill started in a Republican House. It passed, as I recall, 32 to 15 over heavy opposition from environmental groups.
And sorry to interrupt, what bill number is that?
That was House Bill 3038 in 2005. It went to the Senate. We were involved in a lengthy work group. Senator Ringo and Senator Kate Brown chaired that work group. At the end of the work group, we came up with House Bill 3038, and then 3034 was the ultimate place that it ended up. That fixed answered the question of the court, which is, yes, we had the authority to do what you'd already done, and instructed that a work group go off and take a look at the very issues that the court had identified and determine whether or not those ought to be addressed in rule. And a work group took place over the interim, came back in 2009 with the report, and the department enacted a number of those into statute. So I think it's pretty clear that not only did the legislature affirm the authority to implement this program, but also that fixes were made to the program, which were collaborative in nature. I now want to turn briefly to the white sheet that I've handed you. I know that a number of you have received emails on this issue, and I'm always leery to contradict something said by another one of my colleagues in the lobby. And I won't go through this in detail, but I really do think it's important, if you have some time, to take a look at, number one, the allegations that have been made to you in your emails that you've received, and number two, what our response would be. I think in many cases you'll find that we disagree with the fundamental underlying points that have been made by Water Watch. And then I also want to make one last point, and then I'll allow my other witnesses to testify. There are two things that are going on here. We have statements being made that flows in the Metolius are being reduced. We have statements being made that flows in the Deschutes River are being reduced. We have statements made that flows in the Crooked River are being reduced. I want to make it very clear that according to the gauge readings over the last several years in the basin, stream flows are not being reduced. Stream flows are not being reduced. I'll say it again. What is the basis for those comments is that modeling done by the department several years ago, which may or may not include all the factors and may not include enough about this program, suggests that at some future point, stream flows will be reduced because there's a hydrologic effect. If you take a gallon of water out of the ground, you're going to impact a gallon of water out of the river. That may or may not take place. We are all very aware that we first and foremost want to protect the river, and that's the last thing we want to do. But just to be very clear, stream flows in these rivers are not being reduced right now on the ground according to facts and measurements in the basin. And this is something, it's really pretty simple. If you put 150 CFS in the middle of the chutes, it flows downstream to the lower chutes. If you're subsequently taking out 75 CFS in a groundwater permit, you're still putting 150 CFS upstream. So even if there were the one-to-one reduction, which the modeling shows would occur, we do not think that there have been any negative impacts on the river, and the charts indicate that. We've restored over 200 CFS in the basin. We think this is a good program for the basin. We agree wholeheartedly with the effort to bring tourists and fishermen to the basin. We support restoring the river, and it's something that all the interests in the basin continue to work on. So I think I'll end there and appreciate your time today.
Great, thanks. Let's hear from the other few folks on the panel.
Co-Chair Cannon and Co-Chair Gilliam, my name is Brenda Pace, and I'm here for Central Oregon Land Watch, which is a 501c3 located in Bend. I just picked up, thank you to the staff here, what Amendment Number 2 does, which appears to me, and I would like confirmation, please, to reduce the bill to simply extending the sunset. Is that correct?
I don't think we've been in possession of the Dash 2 any longer than you have.
Okay.
So,
oh, it's being passed out right now?
Perhaps slightly longer than you have. I'm going to actually, if it's okay with you, I'm going to turn
ahead.
It back to Mr. Riggs to get a little bit of additional testimony to clarify what the Dash 2 amendments do.
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman, members of the committee, again, for the record, Doug Riggs. The Dash 2 came back from the Council this morning, which is why no one had them. They were drafted because we were afraid that the financial aspects of the bill might cause the bill to get a fiscal and be sent to Ways and Means, and we all know that Ways and Means is not a particularly good place for a bill to be sent, and because every interest in the basin that we've been working with agrees that the most important thing is reauthorizing this program on a permanent basis. So the Dash 2 amendments strike all the financial sections of the bill. And we hope that what will happen is we can put those into a separate bill and have a good debate on the desperate need for the program to have capital to be able to establish a wet water bank, which would give us much more flexibility in order to purchase water credits at a low price, leave them in stream for a long period of time, and perhaps leave them there permanently, and then be able to use them for mitigation in a very long period of time, 20, 25, 30, 35 years. But the Dash 2 amendments were very simple. It's a reauthorization of the program.
My letter that I believe has been passed out now is really addressing the original bill. So you can pretty much eliminate any work in reading it through. But there are three points that remain. We agree with Water Watch that some of the problems that were discussed in the River Mitigation Program Report in 2009 have not been addressed. In fact, of the six items that they discussed as being real problems, the committee could not even agree on what should be done. So there are more things to think about in this program than comes out of that report. The best summary of those problems seemed to me to be a paragraph that said several participants said that we need to have a better understanding of basin hydrology, how much water is actually being used for consumptive purposes in the basin, including exempt wells, and how much is available for continued development and in-stream needs. So without the exempt wells, we don't know as much as we should. We probably don't know as much as we think we do anyway, but that's one of the problems. The second problem, I think, was addressed here, but I'm not quite sure how it is going to happen, in that by far the majority of the mitigation that has occurred has been temporary mitigation. That means paying year after year after year for mitigation. Very little of it is permanent mitigation. And until somebody comes up with a way to convert from temporary to permanent, it's going to be a very large drain on government funds for a very long time. And so that's the second problem that has not been addressed. The third problem, as everybody has talked about, has been the Upper Deschutes. And when do these mitigations, when do these conservations, when do all of these things start addressing the Upper Deschutes? We don't get any recharge from that area. We definitely want the program to continue. We want it to be on a sound fiscal basis. We want it to be organized in such a way that they can attract investment and long-term planning. But we would hope that in this some additional requirement other than as used in 2, use the comments and input to evaluate the elements of the basin plan affecting the area. That is so generic. There are no goals within this. And if we're going to extend it, and if we're going to be confident in it progressing, I think this needs some goals. It had some goals originally. It had some goals of being able to support a nadromous fish. But now it appears to have no goals at all. So I think with some goals involved here, we could support this without any goals and with the problems that we know that exist and need to be worked on. We cannot support it. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Ritchie.
Co-chairs Gilliam and Cannon, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Norm Ritchie, and for the record, I'm from Portland, Oregon. But I'm here today representing our Association of Northwest Steelheaders, Deschutes Basin chapter members, and their concerns with this legislation. Document that I had provided earlier and should be in front of you now does represent the original legislation and not the -2 amendment. So I apologize for that. We'll try to get caught up with that as well. But basically the concern that we had was, first off, the elimination of the 200 CFS cap. And in the testimony we heard today, I wonder why they felt the need for that. We need to have sufficient flows year-round throughout the basin to maintain our fisheries. And we'd like to see something in the legislation that provides that. Also, water temperature. Water quality is very important. And I think somebody else had already pointed out that the water that's being extracted from the ground is cold water, while what's being put back in is warmer. And that is not good for our cold water species. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Chairman, could I...
Doug, go ahead.
Could I respond briefly to a couple of the comments? And I appreciate the testimony. I think we'll find that we actually agree on all these points. First of all, the 200 CFS cap was not even in the original bill for being overturned. What was in the original bill before the -1 amendment was a process by which you could apply to the department to overturn the cap. Water Watch noted to us that that process already existed in rule, and so we agreed with Water Watch and took that provision out because it was not necessary. We fully agree on the need for goals, as the witness pointed out here. Goals are very important. There were goals in Section 2 through 5, which Water Watch objected to and which we've taken out in the -1 amendments, but we still believe very strongly that there are very strong safeguards both in the underlying statutes and in this statute and the rules. Agree 100% on the Upper River restoration, and that's something that unfortunately is largely run by federal reservoirs, and we need some federal assistance and federal help on that. But the Deschutes Water Authority and the Alliance and DRC is working on a federal effort on this. And the last thing I want to say is this is something that I think is important to clarify. The water that is being The mitigation water is not water that has been taken out of the river and then put back in. It's water that we don't take out in the first place. So we agree that warmer water, say from a field or from someplace else, would be detrimental to the river. Instead, this is the water that is just never withdrawn at the irrigation districts at all, and so it continues flowing downstream. So it is at the temperature that it was before it was when it was 5 feet upstream.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. Can you respond to this proposal, I think, from Water Watch that we would put the 200 CFS cap into statute? I mean, I think that's one of their proposals. Is one way of moving forward might be to move that from rule, put it into statute.
Mr. Chairman, I think there are a number of issues that have been raised, for the record, Doug Riggs again, a number of issues that have been raised that are technical issues that the work group in the 2009 interim was unable to reach agreement on, that were presented to the Water Resources Department, and they were unable to reach agreement on, and then went to the Water Resources Commission. These same issues on timing and zones of impact have been raised time and time again. And we share a long-term effort and goals to address issues as they become apparent and as an opportunity exists to fix them. We don't think that those issues ought to be put into a legislative approach. And there were a number of issues dealing with the possibility of aquifer recharge and peak and ecological storage issues that we thought about addressing and putting in the bill, underlying bill in the first place. And we had conversations in the basin, and it was decided that that's best left to the department and to the commission. I think most of those fall into that area. Specifically in the 200 CFS cap, the 200 CFS is not mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, it's not mentioned in the statute. It's something that was established by the department. We think that's a technical, scientific, and public policy issue that is best left to the department. We're comfortable if at some point we need to come back and make a good case that the cap needs to be adjusted either up or down, that the department, the commission, and ultimately the governor will make a decision on that. But at this point, we think it's best just to reauthorize the program and allow the public process to take place.
Thank you. Representative Witt, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doug, on the white paper that you handed out in response to Water Watch, you, in allegation number two, you point out that there have been no rollbacks of existing river protections. That may, in fact, be an accurate case. I don't want to speak for Kimberly or her organization, but I believe the point that she was trying to make was that aside from rollbacks, the concern is that the plan actually never met the minimum criteria. So your level of comfort and her level of discomfort begin and end at two different places, both of which may in fact be accurate statements. And Mr. Chairman, Doug, is that possible?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're getting into very technical details that I am probably not the best person to answer. But I will say that the Scenic Waterway Act targets are difficult to meet even under the best circumstances, especially in what they call the shoulder months. In some years, like today, if you drive over the Deschutes, what you see is extremely high flows because we've had quite a bit of snow and quite a bit of rain. The same thing is true in November and December, October, November and December. So we are not seeing those negative impacts at this point in time, and I don't think we would. We agree that over a long period of time, if we can get to an improved program that provides even greater mitigation and even greater stream flows, that's our goal in the basin. So right now, our mitigation tool is irrigation water in those months. But there are other options that we'd like to discuss at a future point with the commission and with the department when technology becomes available, aquifer recharge, using peak flows for that point at some point down the road. But we discussed that in internal working groups last summer and decided that this was not the time or the place to have those discussions. But I guess my point was that if you look at the numbers, both the Middle Deschutes and Lower Deschutes numbers are up. And as I said at the very beginning, we can argue modeling versus measurements, but largely the comments that have been made are that the modeling shows that there is going to be a negative impact There may be at some point, but we're not seeing those today. And we certainly would not like to see those.
Thank you.
Doug, this is a very minor point, but I wonder whether you would consider amending this blue sheet to include reference to House Bill 3494 from 2005, which I think was considerably more controversial than House Bill 3038 and has quite a bit of bearing on the discussion that we're having today.
I think it is the same thing, and I think when I was typing this at 5 in the morning, I just typed the wrong number in.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
It was 3494 in the process. There were two bills that session. I may have remembered wrong the number when I started and was typing this early in the morning one morning. But
I appreciate that. I mean, sure. I have the advantage of being able to sit here and listen and look them up. And, you know, I'm in politics, so I'm looking at the vote counts, and they're quite a bit different on those two bills. So I think it's worth pointing that out. Great. Thank you to this panel. And let's bring next up, let's go with Dennis Chapman and Sean Jillians, and we'll hear last from the Department from the Water Resources Department at ODF&W.
Hi, my name is Dennis Chapman. I'm a board member of the Friends of Metolius. I'm a volunteer with the organization, and Friends of Metolius is a totally volunteer organization. Our sole purpose is the preservation of the Metolius Basin, and so that's going to be my sole focus today. I am not here to say that stream flows in the Metolius Basin are down. I am merely here to point out to you a rule which has already been referred to by Kimberly from Water Watch, which we feel has the potential of harming the basin, and which we urge you to get fixed and that before approving this legislation. We think that the Deschutes River Deschutes River Conservancy has done a good job administering the program, and we think the program is doing a good job. But we do not favor the lifting of the sunset until some of the issues that were pinpointed in the 2009 report from the Water Resources Department are addressed. And the one that we feel could affect the Metolius is the zone of impact regulation or rule. The particular hydrology in the Metolius Basin is that withdrawal of water from another zone of impact other than the Metolius zone of impact can affect the river. I sent in to Liz the written testimony, and on the second page of that you'll see a picture. And the picture is of spill water, which is groundwater, flowing from Green Ridge, which is the eastern boundary of the Metolius Basin, but the water in that ridge is considered part of the Righteous Creek local zone of impact. So this is groundwater flowing from the Righteous Creek zone of impact into the Metolius zone of impact. If that groundwater is key for the maintaining that unique fish ecology that exists in the Metolius, and which was talked about extensively and celebrated extensively in the designation of the basin as an area of critical statewide concern last session. If that water, that groundwater, is flowing into the Metolius from Green Ridge, is reduced, the way that this rule is currently written is that there would be no mitigation in the Metolius Basin if the primary impact was the Righteous Creek zone of impact. And we feel that this has this is a potential problem for the Metolius, and we feel it's been It's been a known problem for the last couple of years because of the report from the Water Resources Department, and we urge you to, rather than approve this legislation, we urge you to fix this issue among the others that have been highlighted to you, but this issue in particular on behalf of the Metolius before going forward with this legislation.
Great. Thanks for your testimony. Thanks for coming over today.
Yep.
Yes.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillian's representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. For a little bit of history, going back to House Bill 3494 in 2005, there was a bright young staffer for the chair of the House Committee on Water who might be before you today. So that's where I got involved in this originally, and Representative Benz won't take credit for it, but I'll take full credit. I think the plan's working great, care of my hard work. No, I'm obviously just kidding. I think people in the basin have done a tremendous job, and I think when the sunset was originally put in place, it was to make sure that this sort of plan could work and would work, and it was very exciting for me to see actually the success it's had there. I just clarify or point out a few things that we've actually seen increases in flows in the river during the peak of development. This bill was enacted in 2005 at a development pace that likely, unfortunately for my members, will probably never see again, and yet the flows increased in the river, and so I think that's a tremendous success. I'm glad that my colleague mentioned the area of critical state concern. I think when we talk about protecting the Metolius, this legislature made the decision last session to put significant protections on the Metolius, and that was enacted then. We are in support of the bill with the Dash 2 amendments. I picked them up today myself and looked through them when I was sitting in the back of the room. I would point out in the Dash 2, it does require the department to come back and review the program still. It's not like it just gives them point blank that they get to go forward and no changes are made. They have to take in input from stakeholders, and I would imagine that the group that's worked so well collaboratively so far will continue to seek input and provide input to the Water Resources Department. With that, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions on this.
Thanks. Are there any questions for the member of the panel? Great. Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And let's finish with Brenda Bateman, Doug Woodcock, and Kurt Melcher.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Melcher's not here. May I join on his behalf?
You may. We'll just... Are you going to represent ODF&W today?
No, sir, I will not.
Mr. Chair, for the record, members, Mr. Co-Chairs and members, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department, and with me today are Brenda Bateman and Doug Woodcock. So I'm trying to decide how to proceed here, Mr. Chair, because you've heard a lot. Maybe we could just say a couple quick things and then respond to questions. But I think, essentially, we believe that this program, one, it is a unique program in the state. There's no other location in the state where we require mitigation for new water use in this manner. So there's been a burden placed on this basin that we haven't imposed anywhere else in the same manner in Oregon. Secondly, we do believe that the program is working and that the overall results are extremely positive. Thirdly, there are correction mechanisms built into the program as it exists today that require us to come back and evaluate the program every year, annually, and then every 5 years do a full blown evaluation and address corrections that need to be made as a result of the findings of that evaluation. So, co-chairs and members, I would just say that the department is comfortable that the program is indeed working as it was designed to work. It's not a perfect program, but it certainly is working and has been a very positive addition to the water management of this basin. With that, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd turn to Brenda and Doug and ask if they'd have any questions they want to add or comments they wanted to add at this time, and if not, we'll be happy
to. Before you do, Mr. Director, does the department have an official position on this
particular piece of legislation?
The department does not have a support or opposed position on the legislation. I was speaking, Mr. Chair, relative to what we thought about the program itself.
Okay, thanks. Brenda, Doug?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department. I just wanted to add and bring apologies from our colleagues at the Department of Fish and Wildlife who had another hearing this afternoon and asked us to convey their support for the Deschutes Mitigation Program as it works today as well. Thank you.
I have a few questions. Are there any others? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Phil, thank you for your testimony and your support of the mitigation program. I'm wondering, in your opinion, recognizing that I'm not asking you for a legal opinion, but rather one that's biologically and hydrologically based. In your professional opinion, do you think that the mitigation program has met the requirements put forward by the Scenic Waterways Act?
Co-chairs and representative, generally speaking, I think the answer to that is yes. Now, does that mean that we have never bumped a scenic waterway flow to in some minuscule amount? The answer to that is probably no. But in a general sense, have we protected the Scenic Waterway Act and the requirements under that? I believe so.
Thank you.
May I follow, Mr. Chair, just briefly?
Yes.
So part of the challenge with a program of this nature is creating a program that where reality bumps in, where administrative reality bumps into absolute reality from a hydrologic standpoint. So the example I'd give is that this program does not mitigate real time and place bucket for bucket. What it does is it says, if you're taking a bucket out, you have to get a bucket back into the system. If this was part of the issue with the court case earlier, if we were mitigating real time and place, bucket for bucket, moment for moment, essentially you'd be pouring a bucket in every time you took a bucket out. And so what we've had to do is create a program that can function under an administrative reality to address a giant hydrologic issue, this very close connection between surface and groundwater. And in that sense, co-chairs and Representative Witt, I think this program has done a very credible job addressing the requirements of law.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bitts.
Thank you. Just as while you're making general remarks, it seemed to me that this device worked as well as could possibly be hoped, given the alternatives to getting water back into the stream. And so I would just, is that a correct view of what these folks have been trying to do, what you folks have been trying to do in that basin? Because the alternative appears to be litigation regulation as opposed to cooperation, collaboration.
Co-chairs, representative, I think certainly the alternative to having a program functioning of this nature we'd obviously be devolving into legislation because the department would be into a severe regulatory mode in the basin.
He meant litigation.
Excuse me.
I hope.
Litigation. Whatever you said is what I meant, Reverend.
Of course, thank you.
So could you tell us how much room, we've heard some reference to this 200 CFS cap, could you tell us how much room, in fact, is available under that?
Mr. Co-Chairs, for the record, Doug Woodcock with the department. And yes, you've heard of the 200 CFS cap. At this time, the department has issued, I believe it is 128 CFS.
in final orders in the Deschutes Basin. That's about 64% of the 200 CFS cap.
And could you project, I mean, I'm sure this changes a lot, especially based on the economy, but how long has it taken us to get there? How much room does that give the basin for continued growth?
Mr. Co-Chairs, the program has been in place. We got our first mitigation in 2003, and so the program has been in place for about 8 years. It's taken us 128 CFS in over those 8 years. So we still have some 32% of that to go, 32% of that cap to go. So we have several years ahead of us.
Okay. Thank you. Could you speak to a couple of the issues that were identified in the Water Resources Department report from 2009 that we've heard alluded to several times? So, for example, the diminishment of or modeling that shows potential diminishment of flows, if I'm characterizing it correctly, in the spring and the fall, and also this zones of impact question that's been raised. It would be helpful, first of all, for the committee to receive that report, but how are we to look at those two issues? What do the reports say about them?
So, Mr. Chair, we'll let Mr. Woodcock start there, and I'll kibitz if I feel the need it, with your permission.
Mr. Co-Chairs, the first issue, the matter of the winter flows, the issues identified in the 3494 report. It was earlier testified that there were some issues identified as deficiencies in the report. The report actually identified them as areas of concern or issues of concern. And these are issues that the work group, in identifying how the program was working, identified some issues that clearly were areas of concern. They just did not fit that silver bullet category here, and so they were agreed upon to continue working on in the future. One of those is the matter of winter flows. So while there have been some very strong positive gains in the summertime in drainages in the Deschutes Basin, in the wintertime, the shoulders as described, there have been some reductions, and these are reductions that are identified in the modeling report. And the reason why I bring that out as a distinction is that we have some very large flows in the wintertime, and these are flows that are, we're talking about numbers, reductions, that you just can't go out and gauge the stream and be able to identify that. So we have to result on mathematical modeling to be able to identify what these pluses and minuses are. And these pluses and minuses can be quite small. So the kinds of numbers that we're seeing in the wintertime as reductions in flows per the modeling effort are less than 1% of the flows. They're very, very small, whereas the flows that are seen as positive, the gains in the summertime, are very much larger. So that is one of the issues that is there, that is out there, and we've agreed to look at that in the future. Another piece is the issue of zones of mitigation. The program is designed to identify a zone of mitigation, and that zone of mitigation is based upon science. We look at well construction, the aquifer that is being tapped, the proximity to groundwater discharge, and we identify where the area is that needs to be mitigated, where it is that we see the likelihood for a strong groundwater discharge, and that is where we identify the single zone of mitigation to address. So there is an acknowledgement that when you pump groundwater, that impact goes out to multiple zones. The department identifies that zone where that single source of mitigation needs to occur. Mr. Co-Chairs, do you have another point that was raised that you'd like us to address?
I don't.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I appreciate y'all being here. I have not enjoyed fish and wildlife testimony like this for some time. But thank you all for being here. I just had it. You mentioned this is not perfect. Maybe you'd just like to describe 20 or so perfect water projects in the state of Oregon. Anyway, I did appreciate that comment.
Thank you. Well, seeing nothing further, I think we'll release this panel. I would just comment, I think there's a tremendous opportunity here. We haven't heard anyone tell us that this program should go away. And it's not going away before 2014. I don't think anybody wants it to go away then. So I think there's much more that unites the folks who we've heard from today than divides us. And I very much hope that we are able to find a way to move forward with all stakeholders on this in this basin together. We've received a lot of email testimony that I'm not, I guess just for the record, we'll note that we have received a lot of emails from folks in the basin and folks who use the basin. And with that, seeing nothing further, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2867.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
And adjourn the Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. Thanks, members.
What do we do?